This is an interview with Mr. William Naples, University Oral History Program, History of Railroading on the Erie Railroad, at Mr. Naples' home on November 20th at 3 p.m. First of all, I'd like to know a little something about your family and your parents.
During vacation in 1918, as we were doing the war, I went to work on the railroad just for the vacation. And I got fell into an apprentice machine supply job. And when September came around, I quit and went back to school. I went back to school for 1 month and went back to work for the railroad down in 1918 to 1921.
What did your dad do?
He would have been a glassman.
Do you have any brothers and sisters?
I have two brothers and four sisters.
Are they all in your sense?
They're all in your sense. Well, I'm one of them.
You say your parents came from Italy to the United States?
Yeah, and settled in Youngstown right around the mill.
Do you recall what year it was?
1878, and 3 years later he took for my mother.
And you were born
in Far Hill.
In what year? Can you tell me something about your school days and your education?
Briar Hill School and up to the fourth grade, and then the Hill Top School was close to the home for us. And went there up to the seventh grade. That's the only education I had up to the seventh grade.
Where was Briar Hill School?
At between Jefferson and just below Delaware. At Jefferson Street. Disappeared and just near Delaware.
Did they raise the school when they built the new Todd School? Destroy it?
No, it's still there.
Oh, it is?
Yeah, Jefferson School is still there.
They changed the name to Jefferson School.
It was Jefferson all the time.
Oh,
Jefferson School is what I went to. And then when they built Todd School, I went to Todd, and that's as close to our home.
I see.
But it was walking back and forth almost 2 miles. We didn't have no buses then, you know. We had to walk. And both ways, rain, shine, rain.
Was it, I suppose it was grades 1 through 8 in the school, Jefferson School?
Yeah, right.
Was it what kind of school was it?
It's a regular public school, and they had the 3 R's like they had on. They had manual training for the men, and they had the kitchen economics for the girls. That's about all you got at that time, way back before 1910.
So you went to school and then you quit for the summer and you worked?
Yeah, I did. And then I went back, got my job back, and stayed there.
So why did you go back? Why did you decide to go back?
During the war, and the parents was kind of up against it, you know, and then you get a little extra money.
How old were you at the time?
14.
And then did you have to lie about your age?
4 years.
And they believed you?
Well, they didn't care then. They needed men then. Mm-hmm. I mean, they needed help, and I said, kind of war. Well, 16 years, when I was 16 years old, I guess when you're 16, you got an apprenticeship job.
Mm-hmm.
12.5 cents an hour when I started. 12.5 cents. My first full pay, 54 hours a week, was $12.99. I often wondered why they didn't give me that other extra penny.
First of all, would you describe the shop that you worked in 1918?
Well, it's been tore down since then. It was the old machine shop. And they had woolen mills, they had lathes, and they had shapers, and they had planers, and big lathes, hole cutters, drill presses, and punches, and so forth. On one end, and then on the other end, they had the millwrights in there, where they had big saws, band saws, and stuff. Mm-hmm.
Well,
and
how big was it? Excuse me.
And attached to that was a blacksmith shop where they forged all their own molds and stuff and anything in here. At that time, for the steam engine, we had to make all parts. We had to get them made in the blacksmith shop to shape up, and then we'd turn them up in a lathe to fit the engine.
You mean you made all the replacement parts?
Well, yeah, these diesel engines, like automobiles, I go to all the parts store and get your part and sit it in. But the machinists at that time had to make their parts. And even the bushings on the main draws, you had to board them out to the exact size to fit them. But the thing was, they kept modernizing all the time, and you get to know how to make one, and first thing you know, you had to make something different. When they went from solid rod bushings where they went into floating rod bushings, and you had to make one that would press in, another one that would fret, float in there.
Bushing. What do you mean by, where did the bushing fit into the engine?
Well, on the wheels, on the cranks. The main one would be from the piston on the main rod to the main wheel. And it had that was the big one. That was the driver. So the steam pushed your piston back and forth and drove this your main wheel and this wheel. Was connected to two or three or other, all depends on the size of the engine for locomotive. And it dragged the tank.
And it what?
It dragged the tank along filled with coal and water.
You mean the tank was attached to the
locomotive. Yeah, but it seemed like one, so you know what I mean. You've probably never seen a steam engine.
No, I don't think I have.
Yeah, we shut it off, I'll show you one.
Well, how about if we do that later?
Okay.
What was working in the shop like during a day, typical day during the war, First World War?
Well, you were assigned to, like when I first was started, as an apprentice, I was on a bolt cutter, just getting bolts and putting threads on the ends of them, certain, all depends what side bolt they needed,
yeah.
And you thread them. Then after 6 months, I went to the drill press, and you drill holes, different size holes for brake hangers or rods or whatever you needed for. And then later on, then it gradually break into on a shaper, on a planer, and then on a lathe. And then you got it. And you spent, have to have 1,041 days put in before you'd be a machinist. 4 years about.
What kind of unions did you have at the time?
At the time we didn't have much of a union, they were just coming in. They had some, but they didn't have, like they have now. It wasn't compulsory to join a union, and the union was frowned upon in the shops at that time.
Well, then how did you progress by ability or by time in?
Well, that's the shop, the company rules, you know. They had certain rules set up, and you go by that.
Mostly by an hourly, by adding up your hours.
Well, you would progress. You worked, at that time we was working 9 hours a day and 5 hours on a Saturday, I think it was, something like that. But then later on, or 10 hours a day and 5 hours on a Saturday. But anyway, later on, when we got that 8 hour day, we went 8 hours. 40 hours a week, and work whatever your seniority allowed you to work, either day turn or second trick or third trick. You go according to seniority, like you do now, same thing, whatever your seniority. If you could have enough seniority to hold a day job and you wanted a day job, you could. But if somebody else in another turn had more time in than you did, well, they could bump you off, and you'd have to take what's left.
Who was your first official or your first boss? Do you recall?
Ted Cullen. He was the master mechanic.
I see.
And down there, and Ed Deccan was the shop foreman.
Did, or when did you get your first promotion?
Well, they had us, in around 1920, the union came in and got a little bit pretty strong. In 1922, there was a railroad strike. I had 6 months to go, and I couldn't finish it off. I had to wait after the strike. And then during the strike, they took in a lot of these men. They brought them up from the south someplace, and they put them in there. When we went back to work 3 months later, they settled the strike. But all these fellows that was hired during the strike has seniority over the men that originally worked there. They come to layoff, that was the preferred list on top. And they wouldn't touch that. They just took layoff from the men that might say, why not strike?
Well, was that when you organized the union?
The union was organized before that, around 20. In the shop, that's stronger.
Was it organized over the entire railroad, too?
Oh, yeah. Erie. Over the Erie. Erie Railroad had their own union. They was the International Association of Machinists, but each railroad had their own general chairman, right?
Sure.
And they took care of the Erie, Mr. Nestor.
Yeah.
Bill Nestor was the general chairman at that time. His responsibility was the Erie Railroad. But they all accounted to the International Association of Machinists. See, that was organized a long time ago. But to get it around different places took a lot of time.
What were the, why did the men go out on strike? What were their grievances?
Well, if I remember right, the contract shop. They wanted a contract to work out to different companies. So they got mad. And the main reason was to cut wages and longer hours. Like in here, the Wilcoff company was supposed to take the roundhouse over and work for them.
Yeah, what happened?
Well, one kind of a strike, they got out of that.
You mean the company decided
not to
contract them?
Yeah, because they wouldn't go back until things were straightened out, but same way in Meadville. Some other locomotive company they called to go in there and repair a locomotive, and you wouldn't be working for the Erie anymore, indirectly, see.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't get there. In other words, you wasn't worried, the union wouldn't have nothing to say that way.
I see.
Uh-huh.
So,
at that time, I didn't belong to the union. I wasn't a union man. I wasn't a union man until after I was finished my apprenticeship.
Well, did you have to join?
Well, I stayed the first day. No, we didn't have to. I stayed the first day. I thought, they said, you don't have to go out, you're an apprentice. And we didn't do nothing the first day anyway, of the strike. Then when I went out, a bunch of pickets out there said, you better not go back in there. But I did. So I stayed home until in October we went back. This was in July, I think. 3 months it lasted. But outside of that, we had pretty good. I don't think we've been on strike at all since then. I don't know, it's shot. A lot of threatened strikes, but we never lost any time on kind of strike. I've been laid off a lot of times in kind of slack business. The shop that I worked, mostly carried over from Cleveland and down to Sheep, Dube, and probably in the summer months. But then when, during the fall, then they wasn't carrying the salt this far. And, they cut the forces down, maybe fall, just around Thanksgiving or Christmas time, when I get laid off. And then come spring again, when they start calling us back and work. In the meantime, I get jobs someplace else.
There was there any unemployment compensation then?
Nothing. You didn't get nothing then. No unemployment, no compensation of any kind. Medicare, no shop insurance or anything.
And you just simply what your wages
that's it.
Were all you got.
That's right.
After, well, when is the first time that you were laid off, Erie?
1925.
You remember why? The reason?
Reduction in business. Laid way down. See, I was off then until almost a year. Well, they did send me up to, I got married in 1926. Mm-hmm. And I was working at McDonald's at the time. And they called me back to work down to Erie, and I only worked about a month or so, and I got laid off, and then they sent me up to Cleveland. Well, about 6 months later, they had an opening up in Cleveland. I worked up in Cleveland for a while, and we worked in nickel plate engines up there. But it was at East 55th Street.
Well, what happened when the Depression hit? What did you do then?
Well, WPA. With WPA, we worked for the government for a while there. Well, I had put 18 months in it. But every once in a while, I'd fill in when there was somebody laid off or something. Wasn't, they wasn't hiring anybody. But if somebody was off sick or something, I'd get called in to pick up a day here and there.
How are the wages then compared to when you'd started?
Oh, they were a lot better then when I started. See, I started at 12 and a half cents an hour in 1918 when the government took me. The government had taken the railroads over right after that, and they raised me up to 25 cents an hour. And then I got 5 and 6 cents an hour raise every 6 months. And up, but the, well, it must have been made about 60 cents an hour. I think it was 60 cents an hour was making the machines in 1925.
Why had the government taken over?
Well, the war, they had to do that. So this was still, the war was still on in 1918.
Oh, I see. So, and then they reverted back to company ownership after the war?
Yeah. Company, the railroad, the government bought a lot of engines too, you know, going back to the railroad. Hmm. And they had big engines, all kinds of engines.
Come on,
Bill.
Come on, Bill.
We had some great big engines that were supposed to, it was built for Russia, and they never sent them to Russia. They were offered things to work on down there. Great big lumber and things there, and they even couldn't get around them very good, you know. Everything's supposed to be close together.
When was that?
That was right after the war, too, in 1921, I guess.
You mean you were making engines for them?
No, they were made some place, maybe where they made his locomotives. They were made to be sent to Russia.
Mm-hmm.
But then when the war was over, they had to use them up here someplace. They were using them around here.
How are they different from the ones you normally used?
Well, there was a lot of different things. They even had them bumpers in the front, like you see on the English engines, you know.
You need a cow catcher?
Well, no, these were like bumpers beside the cow catcher, just like springs on both sides. I'll show you a picture of that. Yeah, I think I have a picture of them later.
What was the purpose of the bumpers?
I guess the regulations over there, I guess, to bump something, they don't. The spring would take up the a lot of that slack, you know.
Oh, I see. You absorb the impact.
That's right.
I see.
The English, I think, still have that. English engines. And, when I was working up in Cleveland, it wasn't, at that time, I had our first little girl. And going back and forth to Cleveland for a while until we found a room up there.
Mm-hmm.
And I stayed up there 6 months, and then I was called back to the railroad here and worked for a little while, and then got laid off. That's when 1929 I got laid off altogether then.
For how long?
Well, I didn't get back full time until 1937. So I was working off and on a little bit, you know, then I'll call back, and then at 1937, but since 1937, I worked all the way through to 1971, and we had no layoffs. And of course, by that time, I had quite a bit of seniority, and the men that did have the seniority over me, some of retired or passed on, you know. When I retired, I was on top of the list.
I see.
And I've been there, and I was there for about 15 years before. I was top man. I was the ICC inspector for the shop. Inspect engines. I took a job. See, that was one of the privileges of having seniority. That job goes up for a bid right when the man that had it before retired or if you wanted it, you could bid on it. If your seniority was big enough, you or high enough, you could take the job. Mm-hmm. And it paid 6 cents an hour more.
What were the tasks or the duties of the job?
Well, inspecting engines and signing the ICC forms when the engines was inspected, you know. You know these ICC forms they put in the engines?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the blue form. You had to inspect all the items that said on there and make sure that they had all those in good working order, and then you had to swear to them that they was and sign them. And then you get a differential of 6 cents an hour.
Well, what were some of the things you inspected on the engine?
The running gear. And at that time was in the steam engine was gauge cocks and water glasses and steam leaks and air brakes, make sure all the air is okay and your piston travels and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And that's wasn't too many. And then on the other side the water maker had to sign that for their hat for the water and tubes and firewalls and the grates and all that stuff.
How often did you have to do this for each engine?
Well, certain parts of every month.
Sure.
And but like steam and safety valves every 3 months. Safety valves, you know, they pops, if we call them pops, or safety valves at the top of the engine. Some of them had three, some two. They had to be set, but if the pressure got up to a certain pressure, it would release the pressure.
Would an engine have you ever seen a steam engine explode?
No, I've never seen one, but I've heard of one that exploded on the way to Pittsburgh, one of our engines, 2535 was the number of the engine, and it was a passenger train. It seemed like the boiler just went right off it and landed up someplace with nobody got hurt.
Do they ever find out why it exploded?
No, I really don't know. I've heard the rumors that maybe the water got too low.
Mm-hmm.
The water got too low and the top sheet got hot, and when you put the more water into it with what they call an injector. That injector is a steam operated siphon, like the siphons water from the tank to the, and it builds up enough pressure to put the water into the boiler. And when this here water, cold water hit this here hot sheet, like the steam went up so fast that they didn't have time first thing in the morning. Big part went.
Where did they keep the water in a steam engine? Where did they store it?
Well, you mean the extra water?
The extra water, right.
In the tank behind it. That's the tank part of it. What we call the tank. That's the back part of the. They had sometimes an 8-12,000 gallon tank back there, and a cold in between them.
Mm-hmm. How much water, say on a normal run from Youngstown to Kent, how much water would a steam engine use?
Well, all depends. I don't know, maybe about 5,000.
5,000 gallons?
Yeah.
What's a master mechanic's job?
He's a supervisor for all things that goes on in his jurisdiction. Now his was, like, from Prior Hill we had, at that time we had Kent, Levisburg, Sharon. And we had a place in Newcastle. And one time it was a place in Lisbon too. You know, the Niles run, went to Lisbon, they had a little shop up there, hadn't been up there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's about it. He was responsible for all that. Then there was a master mechanic in Meadville, and his jurisdiction was from then on, see.
Well, your duties were to keep all the engines in proper running order?
Proper running order, and you were responsible for anything that went wrong in that division.
If an engine will break down on the road or something.
Like Mahoney Division. Of course, they made the divisions a lot bigger now. At that time, they wasn't so. We had more shops and different little places where they took care of engines.
Hmm. What's a mechanical engineer?
Well, that's the same. Mechanical engineer, that's what I'm talking about.
Well, how about an environmental engineer? What's his job and duties?
Well, we didn't have any of them. We had now what you'd call, wouldn't be an engineer, but he'd have a man for the car department that was on equal footing.
What were his duties?
To see that the cars were in running order and all repaired and available when they needed.
You mean damaged cars?
Well, a damaged car that they could repair them in this shop, he'd have to see that they were repaired, and if they wasn't repaired, they'd have to send them to a bigger shop that done like that kind of work. Like, see, same thing with the locomotives. We done certain amount of work. Then what we'd call at that time back shops. Well, if it was a big damage or an engine had to have extensive repairs, they would send them to these bigger shops where they had more equipment, more men.
I see. What was a chief electrical engineer? What were his duties?
Yeah. Well, at that time we didn't have any electrical engineers. Oh yeah. At first we had these oil lamps. There was nothing electrical on the engine.
Mm-hmm.
Just these little oil lamps, and we had a man there cleaning them up and putting kerosene in them.
Mm-hmm.
But later on, then we got that little steam generator that he set on top of the steam engine. It was run by steam, made generator for lights, for the front and rear lights and cab lights.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they had an electrical engineer for that.
You mean then the chief, he'd probably come along with the diesel engines then?
Yeah, well, yeah, he didn't come, oh yeah. So yeah, the diesel was mostly electric.
No. I'd like to ask you a few questions about the Briar Hill Yard now. What is a hump track?
A hump track?
Yeah.
Oh. A hump track is a track that's raised about higher than the rest of the tracks.
Mm-hmm.
When they want to switch a car to a certain place, they line up the switches to this hump and they push a car over this hump and it'd go by itself now. They wouldn't have to follow it in. Just push it over the hump and then your other yard lines would be all set, so you turn whatever track you wanted.
Switch.
Like one, two, three, or four track.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever the car is going, like you're making a train for number two track or a train for number four, you know which cars go number two or number four, so you have to switch one brakeman or something to stay at the switch. And when he knew where the car's coming, he turned the switch. All he had to do was just turn it over, put the car over the hump, and he all lined up to go in the track that was supposed to go into.
Kind of like a fast way of sorting cars.
Yeah.
Right. What did they use a cripple track for?
The cripple track is cars that, when the inspector comes down, car inspector I'm talking about, when they look the cars over, freight train over, the car's not safe, they put it on a cripple track, and then a car repairman would have to go either repair it there, if he could, if he couldn't, buy it, have to bring it in the yard.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Would you explain or describe a roundhouse?
Well, I'll describe the one we had down there. It was 22 stalls with a turntable in the center.
Circular stalls?
Yeah, around. Like that, they would be round like this, and then you'd have like this. It would be your turntable, and your round. Your tracks come in like this, E22, all around there.
Like spokes of a wheel, then.
Yeah, but only halfway, a little more than halfway.
All right.
And these here, every one of them tracks had pits in. What we call them pits. They would be at first. They only was about 2 feet. Lower than the track,
mm-hmm.
where the men would crawl under to repair anything in the undergear. At that time, we used to have a lot of stuff under to repair, like bearings. We used to have bearings and pack boxes and stuff like that, and renew brasses. We had to get underneath to do that. But later on, through union, I guess, they was forced to put them lower, so you get almost You never had standing room, but you had crawled about 3 feet, 4 feet. And you had a better chance where you didn't have to lay on your belly in water or anything like that.
Nice.
And a car, like an engine, come in from a run out, where they would come to the coal dock first. And they'd take on coal, and they'd take on sand, and they'd take on water, fill a water tank. Then it'd go out to the turntable and go into one of the vacant stalls. If there's any, the men inspector would inspect it, look it over, and find out if anything loose or anything broken or anything, you know. Regular, give it a regular inspection. And he'd have to go underneath the engine, all around the engine, into the cab, try the brake equipment, and see that all the safety appliances are okay and all that. Grab irons, I mean the things on the side of the engine that make sure they're not bent and no sharp edges on them or something like that. And the coupling, see if the coupling works okay and all that stuff. And if there's something wrong, you may get a big report. You may got a report of what's wrong. And you put in the desk and the foreman, the shop foreman, would assign a man to do the work.
I see.
Particular work. If it's a boiler work, it'd be a boiler maker. If it was a tank work or repair work like that, it'd be a car knocker. If it was mechanical work, it'd be a machinist. And if it's pipe work, it'd be a piper.
Oh, I see. How did the roundhouse, or how did the, not the roundhouse, but the
turntable
operate?
Well, at one time, a long time ago, they had to push it around.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they still had to push it if the motor went on a bum bit, but they had it was operated with a motor, electrical motor with, you know, gear down. And, but if you didn't balance the engine exactly right on it, they'd have to make it move so that the traction end would be on the rail. You know what I mean? If it was off balance, like the traction end was over here and on this other end was up, it wasn't getting the traction, so you'd have to put it back. But you don't want to get too much weight on that traction or it wouldn't move because it'd be too heavy.
I mean, you have to find the center of gravity, so you...
Right, so balance to still get the traction.
What's the traction?
The traction would be, they have a big wheel there. That, see, they inside this pit here, there's a rail that goes right around the wall.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a wheel on the... off the motor. The motor was geared down to this here big wheel here. Another gear, and that would turn this here wheel. This here wheel here, why is what operated your turntable?
I see. What did the? When did the old diesel shop? Was it destroyed to make, or torn down to make room for another one?
The diesels.
The
no.
Shop you originally worked in, was that?
No, they tore it down all right, but not to make room for the diesel shop. Was built where the old machine shop used to be.
Well,
that was around 1950.
Well, which building did you work in when you started?
In the old machine shop.
And where was that located at Prairie Hill?
Well, at Stop 7. It's called Stop 7, right there between Youngstown and Niles, Girard, almost on the boundary line. You know where the West End is?
The West End?
Yeah, just before you come to the West End yard office.
And then when did they, were there any other buildings that they constructed between the time you worked in the older building and until the new diesel shop?
No. They added on several times. They've added on, as the engines got bigger and longer, they lengthened the roundhouse stalls to get these bigger engines in. I think they only done that on about five or six stalls.
Yeah.
You know, so they get the long engines in. Some of them, when they start making these bigger engines, they didn't have room. So they had to put about 10, 12 feet on the end of the stall to get the engines in and put more track in there.
Well, are you speaking about diesels now, when you say longer engines?
No, steam engines.
Just larger steam engines?
Yeah, bigger one, longer. And they made the tanks, we call the tanks where they carry the supply bigger so they have more supply, more water, more coal, so they can go farther without having to
Do they still have a roundhouse at Briar Hill now?
No, that was all tore down. They have the turntable there, but the roundhouse was all. They only use a turntable just to
turn engines,
diesel engines on. But the roundhouse was all tore down. It's early 60s.
And what replaced that? Anything?
No, we didn't need anything. They had the diesel shop built by that time.
And so the diesel shop took the place of the roundhouse?
Yeah, well, the roundhouse was mostly for steam. It was equipped for steam, you know, and stuff like that. We'd done diesel work there for a while until they built the new shop. Mm-hmm. And we had a real good modern diesel shop.
Well, can you describe what that looks like inside and out?
Well,
dimensions and things like that?
Let's see. Dimensions, I don't know. We could get three diesels in there, that is these yard diesels, in a stall, one stall. And they had pits in. These pits was pretty good. You could walk in, but you still had the stoop when you inspected the running gear. And about half way up, they had a platform where you could go on top of the engines. And of course, the floor level, you had to go right into the engine room, what we called engine rooms at the time. Like still our engine room.
Approximately, how high was the building? How tall?
It was about 50 feet, I think. And it must have been about 50 feet wide. Mm-hmm. And it must be, closest 100 feet long.
Why did it have to be so?
Or 100 yards long would be better.
Yeah,
I suppose. Yeah, about 100 yards long, but it was about. And on one side, we had an overhead crane. That's when we removed the engines from an engine and replaced the engine. We used to do a lot of that, complete overhaul of an engine. And then we'd have one ready there. We always had an X-ray engine, so if something burned up or broke up in an engine, why, you'd take it on this one side, and that's where the heavy repair is. It's called the heavy repair side. And the running repair side, that's one thing I forgot. There was two tracks for running repair, and there was two tracks for heavy repair in this diesel shop. They all run parallel from one end to the other. You can come in one end, go straight through on two of the stalls, and the other two stalls, you only have to go just in a heavy repair. You just go in one end from the back end.
What's the difference between heavy repair and running repair?
Heavy repair is work that takes a long time to do, or heavy work, in other words, heavy that you can't do it right away.
Mm-hmm.
Running repair is like an engine is called and it's got a couple little jobs you want to do on them. You've got to get them done before the engine goes out. So if the engine's called for 3 o'clock, and you could maybe have 2 hours to get the job done, so the engine can be dispatched at 3 o'clock.
So running repair is kind of like minor repairs.
That's right.
And
right behind there was a big storeroom where you get all the parts. Mm-hmm. And alongside we called there was an oil room where all kinds of different oils and greases was kept for the different parts of the locomotive.
Okay. Anything else?
And we used to fill our own oil during the Second World War. We had the oil was kind of scarce, and we had the big oil filling machine in there where we'd reuse the oil again. When we drain the oil out of the engine, there could maybe 3 or 4 barrels of oil in an engine. That's 150 gallons, a little better. But we'd save that, and then they'd run it through this machine and fill it again, and put some added stuff in it and use it.
Did it perform as well as new oil?
And they claim it does. It did, yes. And most of the guys, chemists and everybody used to come down and check it every once in a while to see that it was okay, good if it wasn't good oil. And when they get in that crank set, just like your automobile, if you don't have good oil in it, why, you're going to have a lot of burnt bearings. And the bearings held up pretty good.
What kind of lubricants did you have to add to a steam engine?
On steam engines, all we had is just regular heavy oil and moving parts, grease for the main rods and side rods. Mm-hmm. And they had a heavy oil that what we call a valve oil. This was connected to a little a lubricator that was run mechanically with the movement of the engine, and that would feed drops of oil into the cylinder that operated the pistons and the valves.
Right.
And I keep them lubricated.
Well, what kind of lubricants did you have to add to a diesel engine?
Mostly oil, crankcase oil.
Any other kind?
No, mostly crankcase oil. Once in a while you'd have to look at the governor and see if the governor needed oil. They had a governor that governed the speed of it.
Governed the speed of the engine?
Yeah, and it was operated with oil pressure. And if the oil pressure was, if the oil level was way down, why, your engine would stop.
Which one, which engine was more complex, a steam engine or the diesel engine?
The diesel engine would be more complex because it had more moving parts. You know, it depended a lot on electrical work too.
Well, which one was more difficult to repair?
Diesel.
Which one did you prefer to work on?
Steam.
Why?
I was born with it, you might say, and we had to make the parts, and every part was, it was part of you, you might say. You made it, and you put it on there, and made it fit. And when you make something, make it go, you put something wear on it, just like changing parts. I mean, they're diesels. Yeah, we didn't have to make, once in a while, maybe we'd have to make something, but still, they have these parts in the storehouse. You go in the storehouse and get them. But if you could repair a part, and they didn't have a new one to put in, well, then it would have been all right. But on steam engines, we had to make all our parts, most of our bolts we had to make, main rod bolts, and wrist pins for all our guides and things like that. I'd even make what we call gibs, the slides, you know, the things that slide back and forth on the side of an engine.
I'm not sure if I do or not.
On a crosshead.
Is that it?
They're gibs. They slide between two guides. That keeps your piston straight.
Right, sir.
And if they're not, these gibs, if they're not the right thickness on the bottom, they'd come down too low, and then you'd have a steam leak after you're packing. See, there would be a packing at the one end of it, and it's supposed to hold steam in. You won't handle a leak, but if it leaks, well, then you have a lot of steam going out of one end.
Well, could you describe the major parts of a steam engine and the method in which it operated? Just the major parts, not all the minor parts.
Well, the main thing on them, I think, would be the operating part would be your valve and your cylinder. Your valve operated. Allow just enough steam in to push the piston and the crank back so your wheel would turn.
Mm-hmm.
And after it got it to the extreme end, this valve would be on the other end enough to release the steam from one end and emit steam in the back end to push it the other way. And it just got to keep back and forth. A valve on top is working like this. And when your piston's going this way,
back and forth.
Yeah, this other valve just moving slowly enough to get your steam in the back end to push it towards the back, and then by the time it gets to the end, it's got to start feeding the steam in the back end, push it back, and by that time, it's got to release this here, exhaust the steam in the front, and pick up the steam from behind.
Okay. How big was the boiler, steam boiler?
Different sizes. It had some bigger, maybe about 5 foot in diameter, and it would be about 20 feet long. No, some bigger and some smaller. And that's another job we'd have on steam engines. Up there on top is a dome with a lot of bolts around it, and it's steam tight. But inside there, when the steam is all out of it, we'd have to go in there, crawl down that dome into the boiler, and repair
into the what?
The boiler.
Boiler. Okay.
But it's cooled down by this time. Sometimes if they had a hot job and had to get it done right away, you might have to sweat a little bit. But then there's a valve in there which is operated from the cab. That when you pull the throttle in the cab, just open up this little valve and let the steam through this air valve in a dome, and that's the steam that operates your cylinders. This control is controlled from the cab. Sure. But then if a pin or something had broken there and had a leak, we had to get down there and repair that and all the connections.
What kind of fuel did they use to
coal.
To steam the engine?
Coal.
Oh, just coal?
Coal.
That's the only thing. How?
Of course, the coal was later on. They had the first they had the shovel up, and then they had the stokers, you know.
Right.
All the firemen had to do was get the coal down so that it could go in the troughs.
What was the difference between a steam engine, or the passenger engine and the freight engine?
Well, the freight engines were heavier, and so you had a bigger load to carry. And their wheels were smaller for more power. And the passenger engines were bigger wheels and had a faster stroke and more trim.
Do you remember that? Well, compared to a steam engine, how much more horsepower would a diesel engine produce?
Well,
I think the diesel engine today produces, I think, the largest Erie engine produces 3,600 horsepower. How much do you recall how much the steam engine produced? Do you remember any engine, the names of the engines?
B5, that's the small engine, then it has a K18, A18, and then some of these classes, if you had a letter in behind, you mean you had some kind of extra equipment, like maybe two air pumps.
If an engine had a prefix, what did that stand for?
In different parts, they had something added onto an engine where other engines, the regular engine, didn't have. Not they had just a regular, like G5A, and there was an extra air pump on or something, a little extra equipment on it. And then you had pony trucks or something. Pony trucks, I mean, road trucks in the front.
What's that?
We call them pony trucks, but they were an extra set of wheels in the front of an engine, in the front of the driver. Not the engine, in front of the driving wheels. So you maybe one, sometimes they had a pair of them on each side. And that's how they class engines by the wheels. Like two, three, and first would be four.
Per side?
Yeah, per side, that's right.
What were the pony wheels?
Well, the ones in the front, more of a leader like.
Were they weren't driver wheels, though?
No, nothing connected. They just, more for balance, I imagine, or something like that. They're driving wheels and help carry the load in the front.
You know, remembering, were there any popular names or nicknames for these?
One I remember is Sandtail, and the light passengers were high wheels. And,
remember an engine, was there ever an engine called a Berkshire, I think?
Berkshire?
Berkshire?
No, we had a few engines on there, and a few fresh started with names on them. It was like one man, one engineer that had his name on, like Jay, one of the Jay, John Jay, I think it was. And he'd get that engine every day, just like his use. Wouldn't have been one else. In other words, you wouldn't work unless you had that one engine.
Yeah.
thing, put his name on it. Mm-hmm. There's a couple others, but I don't remember the name.
Do you remember which companies made the names of the companies?
Baldwin made most of our engines. Baldwin locomotives. And the valve gear engines were made by two or three different companies, like Stevenson, valve gear, Chase valve gear, and then there was another one that I don't remember, but then two.
How about later, when they started making diesel engines, which companies made that?
Alco.
Which one?
Alco. Some of them were Alco, and some of them was Baldwin Lana. See, it's probably the same Baldwin company that used to make the steam locomotives. Probably went to diesel, and they wound up to Lana. In a Hamilton with
Lana engines, too.
Hamilton and Lana. Together,
yeah. Sure. So, which type of engine was more dependable, a steam engine or a diesel?
Well, there's so many parts on a diesel that could go wrong. Electrical. But on a steam engine, you could always go out and unless something was really broke, you'd always be getting in.
Mm-hmm. You mean bring them back to the shop?
Bring them back to the shop or get them going. The most delicate thing on the steam engine was the air pump. And if something went wrong with an air pump, you couldn't do much out without it unless you had maybe just a small valve but you could change out the rule, but you couldn't on a diesel engine. It wasn't much. But they had an advantage. There's always two diesel engines. If one broke down, the other one always could bring it in. And the bigger engines, bigger diesel engines, had two engines. One down, they'd have to cut the load, but if they could, if they had to, cut the load and they'd still get in. But the steam engine, unless they broke the main rod or a wheel or something like that, or a tire come off, they usually could get them in.
So their steam engines are more durable?
Oh, yeah.
Which ones are more efficient?
Diesel. I think the diesel.
Just because they have a larger capacity?
Yeah, and they're available all the time. You know? In other words, a steam engine, when you have a steam engine, if you let a steam engine stand, you have to have someone to watch it, keep the water in it, and keep the fire going. Your diesel engine, so they're just like your automobile, they got to go until you need it again.
How often did you have to put water in your engine, say on a run from Youngstown to Kent? How many different places did they stop to get water?
Well, if they left Youngstown, if the tank wasn't too big, all the time they did the tank was, mm-hmm. You know, capacity of the tank. And they'd probably pick up water at Leavittsburg, and then they'd get another, water there
at Leavittsburg. Across the division from Meadville to Kent. Would they have to stop at all? Larger steam engines?
I don't know, really.
Okay. How many different sizes of engines did they have, and what was the purpose for the different sizes?
Well, now the B5 is mostly for switching, maybe in a small yard or someplace, a small plant. Mm-hmm. And custom field used to have these B5, the small ones, go in there and switch the car by the plant, go in machine two. Like they're using these small, they're now using these small diesel engine machine too. And they couldn't put a big one in there. They could, but it wouldn't be profitable. And then there's about three or four different size diesels. The bigger ones are what we call 900. They're using them for switching in their yards now, where they used to use these small, ball ones.
Steam engine?
Yeah. The line of Hamilton engines that you see in the yard small. But they got rid of all them. They don't have no more of them small ones. They got some of these, I don't remember all the names anymore.
Do you remember what they did with the steam engines when they changed from steam to diesel? Did they scrap them or?
scrap them. Somebody probably bought one or two for a museum someplace.
Did you ever have a, did you have a favorite engine you like to work on?
Well, not particular. It made no difference. They're all was a challenge for everyone.
This might be a little difficult with the changing value of money today, but do you think a steam engine was more costly than a diesel, or the other way around?
Can't answer that one, either. No, I don't know.
During the war years, the Second World War, did things change differently? Were things different than during normal times for you as a man in a diesel shop?
Well, during the Second World War, we didn't have diesels.
Or during
the... We still had steam. We didn't get diesels, I think, till 1948.
Did you have to work a lot on it?
They had more men. And I think the government is picking up the biggest part of the check. You know, some of the engines was cross-bus, and it worked for a lot for the government. But there's still a lot of Erie Railroad.
Mm-hmm. Were there ever any security checks on engines?
No. There might have been security checks on freight trains when they went out there, you know, mm-hmm. make sure that the equipment's all right and no sabotage or anything like that. As far as the engine is concerned, I haven't seen anybody around.
Do you remember some of the men you used to work with? So Andy, say in the 30s and the 40s?
Oh yeah, I remember Nick Denicio, Nellie Osborne, and Joe Vitale, Gucci, Nick, and Nick DeRamo, Joe Lambert. A lot of them, right? Vernon, Clay Vernon, Natale, Nagel, Dillon. Oh, I go down. It takes time to think them up, but there's a lot of them.
What, I suppose you weren't working constantly, or during the day. I suppose you had a few breaks here and there.
Oh, yeah. Railroad is like that, but no, you're just trying to deny it. You get your breaks.
What'd you do in your idle time while you were in the shop?
Not too much. Some of the fellows find ways to keep them busy, but doing nothing, but if they could get your job done, then, you know, you're waiting for another assignment, why then you've got full time.
Did you ever have to leave the shop and go out on the road someplace, travel to an engine to repair?
Yeah.
What did you have to take with you?
All depends what they, we take as many tools we thought we needed, but if there was a big job, then you have to, like if the wheels or a bearing or a trailer brass that was burnt or something, then you'd have to take jacks. Mm-hmm. But most of the time you just don't have enough to go out. A lot of times we went out mostly for trailer brasses or general box brasses we had to go out. And on journal box, you didn't have to jack the engine up, but you had to get underneath the engine out in the road, and it was a hard job to try and get under because you didn't have no pit. Mm-hmm. And you had to squeeze down there and get the old brass out and try to get that your grease cake. Most of them had grease cakes in at that time under the journals. You get that all that old stuff out and put a new one in there and try to get it there. And that's when we kind of get in the shop without getting hot again. Same way on trailer brasses. The trailer brasses, if the journal wasn't scored, you'd be all right, but if the journal was scored some, you'd have to smooth all the rough spots off the journal and put a new brass in there, put enough grease in there, and oil and pack in that it would stay like that. Because if it didn't, if it got hot again, it would melt all the babbit off of the brass and then...
Melt all the what?
The babbits.
What's that?
That's something like lead. It's the soft metal that's underneath the brass. That supposed to keep your wheel nice and smooth and running. And if your wheel got hot, your journal got hot, it would melt this brass and down on both sides of it into the packing underneath. Mm-hmm. And it started getting hot, and first thing you'd have a fire there. Wood started to burn.
Did you ever have to work on engines from another railroad?
The only place I've done that is up in, when I was in Cleveland. I was worked mostly on nickel plate engines.
Were they any different from your engines?
Not much.
If there was one thing, or there were a few things that you could change that you think would make things more efficient, make your job easier or better, you know any that you'd like to see, Nate?
At the time, no. You would assign a certain job, and it was up to you to get it done and do the best you can on it. That's all. If you need help, why you just go to the farm and ask them for help, and they'll usually get it.
Were the foremen men from the union, who were promoted?
Well, they would know. There were no union men. Foreman wasn't union men at the time. But I think later on, in the latter years, they were allowed to join a union. They wasn't allowed to join a union as a foreman. I think the company was not allowed to join.
Well, is your boss a man who had just worked on a railroad and had been promoted through various jobs until he reached a foreman's position, or was he a man who had gone to maybe a special trade school to learn various
parts? Must have had some kind of training, but most of the fellows that come as foremen down here come from a different shop. Like, we had a lot of men here, well, one of them, like Luke Holland, he come down from Kent. He was down here quite a while. Now his son is a foreman down here, Joe Holland. And then Joe Wheels, he come from Meadville. Harvey Carr, he come from Meadville. And we had a fella from Cornell come in here. Another fella from Marion. Mm-hmm. So usually, very seldom they get a man from the local shop to be a foreman. I don't know why. Maybe it's because they know everybody pretty closely, you know, good friends with everybody, and it's pretty hard to have a friend give it nasty jobs up there.
Did you ever get bawled out for something you did wrong?
Oh, yeah. Call on the carpet. I don't know why, but sometimes during my inspection, while I was inspecting the time, sometimes you might miss something. And then the engine goes out and they have a failure with it. The engine goes out and can't complete his run or something like that. Then they call you and want to know why you missed it. They know why, you can see it. And then they have to make a statement and they look a little closer in the future and try to do better and okay.
Try not to be human in the future. Do you remember your most embarrassing moment? The biggest mistake you made?
I've had them, but I'm sure I had them. I don't remember what they are now.
Did you have to spend did you have to spend time away from your family, or were you home every night?
Mostly home every night. Unless, like you said, we get a call on a breakdown, mm-hmm. We'd have to go out, and maybe we can get back maybe 2 or 3 hours after quit time. But they always leave word and have someone call home, but it's going to be a little late or something. And sometimes you get a chance to work a little extra, if you like working over, doubling over, like they call it. It's short, like the trick following you is short of man or 2 men, and they need somebody. If you turn to work and you want to work, and then I'm double over, why? Yeah, double over.
Nice.
Like you start at 7, quit at 11, then get to that night. 16-hour term.
Do you do that very often?
Not too often. I've done my share of it, but to help out. A lot of times they couldn't get anybody, and sometimes they had a lot of men, but as long as they get somebody, they didn't want to work. Mm-hmm. I'd help out, you know, if the rather seemed stuck.
Do you remember the most memorable incident that ever occurred to you? Was there maybe something like a major accident or something of that sort that really sticks in your mind?
A major accident was during the Second World War, I think it was, when I was running passenger trains up to the arsenal in the accident. Mm-hmm. And one of them was going up there, it was pretty foggy, and a big freight train, it was 3,400 I think was on it. Come down out of the train and run square into this train. And it was a miracle, nobody got killed, a few hurt, nobody got killed. And some of them coaches, the rail went through the coach and just cleaned every seat right out of it. See nothing in there, not a seat left in two or three of them coaches.
But nobody was hurt?
Nobody was hurt. It's bad, I mean, that's what I hear. And we got the engine down the shop, and the engine was almost a total wreck. Great big locomotive like that. But one of the biggest ones we had, 3,400 at that time, was a big engine.
Did you ever have a chance or an opportunity to go to another railroad and look over their diesel shop or exchange ideas with men who worked in the others? Do you think you feel like there's another job you might have liked to have done on the railroad besides the one you had done, or were you kind of happy in what you were doing?
I always think the grass is greener on the other side, but I don't think so. I was satisfied. I had a good living down there. Kept my family going. Didn't make a lot of money, but then shut the roof over our head, bread on the table.
Do you think that let's put it another way. Did you prefer working, say, in the 30s and the 40s compared to the 60s? Or you think it was easier to work during the 30s and the 40s?
No, I don't think so. It's not the same.
I mean, as far as the attitude on the railroad is concerned?
Well, the attitude got a little stronger in later years, you know what I mean? They demand a little more. But you didn't have to give them any more to you. That was what you could, you know. You couldn't get any more out of you. You didn't want to do it.
You think then that, as far as you're concerned, did the railroad change drastically over the years, or was it just more or less a gradual change?
It was a gradual change. Well, every time you got a new supervisor, of course, you wanted to make a better showing, or if you got a new president, everybody wanted to make a better showing, and clamp down, but then it always went back to the same.
How about a cup of coffee?
Good thing.
Like you, Father.
No, thank you. Things like that. Then we had these other little shops like Leavittsburg, Niles, and Corona, and Newcastle. Newcastle's not there no more, but Niles about done, and so is Leavittsburg. You gotta know about Corona. And there was mechanics up there, and we'd get a chance to go up there and be foreman once more. I got my share. Well, of course, you didn't have no men. Well, you had yourself, but you was classed as a foreman.
Was Briar Hill Shop one of the larger shops on the railroad?
No. It is now, but at that time it wasn't. It was just a regular, just a shop. Meadville was bigger, and Kent used to be bigger. Kent's not there no more. Kent's wiped out altogether, nothing up there at all. Now it's Marion and Hornell, the two biggest shops.
Well, were the shops eliminated because they changed the diesels?
Right. The diesels go longer between, had to repair the line. And that's about it. They didn't have the heavy work. You take the steam engines, they required more attention than the diesel. Like I said, you take a diesel, you can set them someplace and leave them there, where Where a steam engine, you got to have constant care almost. You got to keep, like I said, keep the water up and keep the fire going. You can't leave them for too long. Diesel engine, you can lock them up and leave them and go back a week later and start them up and the battery's going to bid.
What have you done since you retired?
I think I worked harder since I retired. I go back to work and rest. No, I enjoyed my retirement.
He's got dishpan hands and housemaid's knees since he retired.
I got lodge work. I joined the, I belong to the lodge. And I'm pretty active in Knights of Malta. You ever hear that?
I've heard of Malta, and I suppose I've heard of Knights, but not the two together.
Yeah, Knights of Malta. It originated in 1048, and it's by about six or seven, at that time they were called monks, I guess, to take care of the sick, and it's been going on ever since then.
What do you do today in the organization?
Well, we don't take care of the sick, but we visit the sick, and mostly in religion order. We'll visit the sick or help out where we can and try to keep it together. Of course, right now, it used to be all over the world. At one time, they had a navy and an army and with a military, crusaders. And they started out with the Knights of St. John's of Jerusalem. And then Knights of Rhodes, now it's Knights of Malta. Mm-hmm. A few more names in between there. The Knights of Malta is from, they got that name when they had the island of Malta. It was given to them by the Kaiser from Germany. I forgot what his name was, but anyway, he gave them the island and they stayed on it for a long time until it was taken away from the infidels, they call them.
So you visit local hospitals today?
Yeah.
Are you a member of any other organizations?
No. Well, there's Erie Vets. Erie Vets and Chatterbox and a couple of other like that. You know. But I'm actually not a lodge man. I just, for some reason I got into this thing. I don't know how. Right now I'm the head of the Ohio delegation of Knights of Malta. Grand Commander of Ohio.
You're the Grand Commander. Do you have a, is it, I take it then as a national organization?
It used to be worldwide. Mm-hmm. Headquarters in Scotland. But it's down now. I don't think we have a headquarters in Scotland. At least I didn't hear. Just in the United States and Canada. But still it's narrowed down to about four states. It used to be all over the world at one time. Now we're down to about four states. Mostly a religion out of it. Strictly Protestant now. It used to be, well, at that time it was under the Roman Empire until 1560. And then they divided and they followed the Martin Luther and they stuck to the Protestant side of
it. I see. How many kids do you have?
Three. Two boys and a girl. One boy passed away when he was 29 years old. He worked for the Erie too. He was a fireman.
I see. How about your other son? Did he? Is he a railroader too?
No, he's a production engineer. He started out with General Motors, but now he's up at Detroit. He's still in Detroit, but he's with a sales outfit, Edwards Company.
Was there a history of railroaders in your family, or
no,
were you the first?
First.
How about your brothers? Any of your brothers
get
involved in the road?
No, my two brothers. One's a body man, the other one was a structural iron worker.
Well, is there anything else you'd like to add? I kind of ran out of questions, I think.
That's about it.
His son was a fireman.
Yeah, I told him that.